Welcome to the Azure Podcast, a series of short discussions on various topics related to the Microsoft Cloud Platform. Your hosts, Kendall Roden, Cynthia Krang, Kale Teeter, Evan Vasilik, Russell Young, and Sajid DeMello discuss a specific topic on each show to give you a high-level overview of that topic and resources to get more information should you wish to dig further. For more information on our show, please visit our website at azpodcast.com.
Well, welcome back to the Azure Podcast. This is episode number 292, being recorded on the 14th of August, 2019, with special guest Kevin Lam. I'm Sajid, and on Teams with me, I have Evan, and of course, our special guest, Kevin. Well, we're going to get to him in just a minute. Of course, Kevin's been on the show before. He's no stranger to the Azure Podcast.
He's a veteran.
He's a veteran, yeah, absolutely. We appreciate him taking the time to come on yet again to talk about something new and exciting. But before we get there, Evan, let's just do a quick roundup on the Azure News space. What do you got? I know you put a bunch of things in there. Thank you for that.
Yeah, no, a couple of things kind of jump out at me. The first one is that, you know, so IoT is growing and growing right these days. And so recently we've now made sure that Azure DevOps projects and pipelines now support IoT Edge, right? So this way you can now do, you know, CI/CD for your IoT Edge projects at that point, which is great, right? That used to be a manual step on top of everything. Mm-hmm. The other one, this one's kind of more, it's not Azure per se, but I came across it and thought it was super interesting. So Stack Overflow does a survey around, you know, a bunch of different aspects, but one of them they do is what IDE you're using. I don't know when it became true, but as of today, VS Code is actually the number one IDE across all developers.
Wow.
Which is amazing because it's only been out, what, 2, maybe 3 years? It's a great one. Anybody who's not using it, I do recommend you check it out. I mean, there's some things it can't do. You still need full Visual Studio for some things, but for your day-to-day stuff, I do all my stuff in VS Code.
I agree. Yeah, that's a great one. Well, AKS is something that I'm very close to, and glad to say that AKS is now finally available in the Azure Gov region in preview. So this is in the Fairfax, Virginia area, which is actually very close to where I am today. I'm in DC, and so glad to see that AKS is available to our government customers now.
Yeah, that's great. Don't go wandering over trying to find that one. We'd like you to stay. Not disappear. Where's the G go? So another one. This is real close to my heart, given my background in networking. But so it used to be we had, or we still do, but we're deprecating the data center XML files, and we're replacing that with a service tag discovery API. So basically, an API you can call and say, "Hey, for this service, give me the ranges. For this region, give me the ranges." This allows people to dynamically make those calls and just get the ones they want, right? Versus having to parse out the XML and all that stuff.
So I remember you had written an API a long time ago, right, Evan?
I did. Yeah, I wrote a proof of concept. So I'm going to have to, I'm actually going to try and get the dev, the PM who owns this, on the show, and I'm going to have to, you know, figure out how he stole my code to do this. But yeah, no, this has been a kind of a challenge for people for a long time. And so it's great to see that we finally, Office moved to this maybe a year ago. So it's great to see Azure adopted as well.
And then we've got GitHub Actions for Azure have been announced. So now, you know, you could do complete CI/CD from GitHub itself. You could do besides just source code repository, you could also do some things like deploying software or deploying things to Azure. So if you quickly want to, you know, check in code and have it built out, yeah, you could use Azure Pipelines, or you could also use GitHub Actions to do some of that. So that's something that's newly available. What else we got? Cosmos DB version 3.0 SDK is now available. So we haven't had somebody on from the Cosmos DB team in a while. Things about time we get an update from them.
And it's evolved a ton recently. So yeah, we probably ought to. Another one. So, you know, one thing people ask about all the time is what's the best way to do stuff in Azure, right? What's the best practice? And we've now kind of released a single source for this stuff. And we'll put the URL on the site, but definitely a great place when you're starting a new project, starting a new workload. Go check it out and kind of learn what mistakes not to make up front.
Okay, like a best practices
thing,
yep. Right? Yep. Oh, it's a single source, so everything's in one place. I see that. Yeah.
Yeah, these used to be kind of scattered around, right? So mm-hmm. So now we've kind of aggregated this all.
Excellent. All right, I think that's a good roundup on the news. Thank you for posting all of that. Anything else you want to cover before we get started, Neb?
No, I think let's find out about Azure Functions and ICE.
Okay. Well, Kevin, thank you again for joining us. Please go ahead and introduce yourself to our listeners and let us know what you're working on these days. I know you've been on the show before, but what's hot these days? Go ahead.
Certainly. My name is Kevin Lamb. I'm a principal program manager on Azure Logic Apps, not Azure Functions. And that's okay. We've been really busy working a lot of new capabilities for Logic Apps. And one of the biggest asks that we've had from customers is the ability to integrate Logic Apps into their VNets. And so we've always had a capability of being able to create a gateway with reverse proxy to allow access for it. But a lot of our customers have much more stringent security requirements when it comes to networking. And so they really want network injection and the ability to really lock down the orchestration that we provide with Logic Apps and all that integration capabilities, but still access their on-premises entities and still participate in the rest of the cloud in a platform as a service manner.
That's great. So, I know you've been on the show twice at least for Logic Apps, but, and it's been over the past 5 years that we've been live over here. But mm-hmm. give our listeners a bit of a refresher on what Logic Apps is and where it lives in the Azure, which service is it part of and things like that.
Certainly. Azure Logic Apps is our enterprise integration platform as a service, kind of core service provider, that service proposition that we have. And it's really part of the Azure Integration Services collection of capabilities we have in Azure. Those other services that kind of get bucketed into that AIS set is API management, Service Bus, as well as Event Grid and Logic Apps. And so we have messaging, APIs, and orchestration together kind of create that great IPaaS platform, with Logic Apps really acting as that heart of being able to do the orchestration. So it provides a nice cloud-based workflow engine and over 300 connectors that allow you to integrate with anything from Azure services to cognitive services to Office to Salesforce or your on-prem, or create your own custom connectors so that you can create these really fast, low-code, no-code means by which to integrate these things. So you don't have to be a advanced integrator like in the old days. If you were building out a BizTalk type of integration platform, you had to get specialists that really understood that platform and the black magic that happened in the message box, etc. Where now anybody can approach Logic Apps and start doing their integration from something very simple. It's like, hey, show me all of the sentiment of the tweets that are coming in for my product and put them into a Power BI dashboard, to more classic integrations where I'm taking doing asynchronous messaging processing for in-order delivery of convoys through something like Service Bus into my back-end line of business systems, or doing B2B EDI workloads. So we do that whole gambit for you in Logic Apps, all with no code.
That's great. So this is deployed into my, projected into my VNet, and I can use my same Logic Apps, my same, design, everything that I'm doing in the public version of that. That's probably not quite the right word, but I can take the same stuff and drop it into this ISE environment, right? I don't have to make changes to do that.
Yeah, the only thing you'll need to do, so when you go, what we've done is when you create your Logic App, you typically provide a location, which is a region, like, mm-hmm. West US. And if you've created an ICE in your subscription, then you'll have included in that list of locations your ICEs. So we treat an ICE almost like a location.
Oh, so it shows up just like a region. Oh, okay.
Yes, exactly. So one of the things that we like to think of the ICE as is your own private region. And so you create an ICE and it acts as a host. So the back end of what we provided for the ICE is the same as what we do in the public cloud, just your own private, smaller version of that. And so it really acts as a host for your Logic Apps.
Oh, that's great. That's perfect.
But all the behaviors are the same. You know, there's some better things you can do with your logic app in the ICE, but functionally it acts the same. We just have extended some capabilities and ways you can reach out to other entities from the ICE that you couldn't do from the consumption cloud.
Now, Kevin, remind me, I remember logic apps. Was it not part of the app services at some point? And so we broke away now as an independent thing? Is that how it is?
No. Well, yeah, that's a common confusion. We've been part of the, how should I say this, the business model for some time, very, very early on. But we broke out of that business model. But architecturally, we were never, Logic Apps was never part of App Services. So one of the reasons that we separated that business model is because a lot of people were getting confused with the App Services architecture and where Logic Apps ran, and they really were not related at all. So there is no correlation there.
So sorry. Go ahead, Sujit.
No, go ahead.
I was going to say, So that actually, I was actually confused because I was in my head mentally mapping, you know, the ICE to the ASE, right? The application service environment, which is
sure.
The independent one. So they are totally different. Okay, that's good to know.
They're totally different. They are similar in capabilities and in conceptual, but they are completely distinct offerings and architectural entities.
So how does the size of the compute that we have behind logic apps, how do you determine that, and is this something that you just pay for the entire environment that you provision, or is it like per request base? How does that work?
Right. So in consumption cloud, you know, logic apps is a serverless offering, and some of the attributes of serverless include things like you don't have to worry about the infrastructure that you're building on. You don't have to worry about the scalability. You don't have to worry about billing is done in a micro billing fashion, meaning, you know, as there's a ticking meter for each time you use something in the app, in the logic app. And if you're not using it, you don't get charged. Sorry, that's the serverless model. With the ICE, essentially what you have is now you have bought a host, and any logic app that runs in it, you don't get metered on those logic apps. Since you're paying a monthly fee for that ICE, then any logic app that runs in there, there's no fees that get come back from those executions. So you can go party on that as much as you want. Now with the base unit provides approximately 160 million transactions per month. But we have, you can scale it out with processing units, and you can add an additional 10 processing units, each with an additional 80 million. So that gives you an additional 800 million executions you could do in that environment.
I'm having a difficult time getting that number of executions into my head. You can do a lot of work on the base.
You can
model.
Do almost a billion executions a month to completely scale that thing out. And we have customers that actually do that type of workload. So it's not we haven't picked some, you know, arbitrarily large number. It is something that's a, you know, some of our top customers actually do.
Yeah, but when now I'm paying for the infrastructure. I don't have to manage it, but I'm paying it. Do I have to do anything special to make sure that my ICE stays in sync with the code that's being deployed? Like, you know, there's special configurations I have to do to my VNet to make sure that, in essence, Microsoft can push in any updates, or is it just by default that happens and we're totally managing it for the customers?
Yes. That's a great question.
Okay.
So your thought process is correct. So, you know, the ICE, the integration service environment, is a PaaS, right? We're providing a platform as a service. You don't have to worry about updates, et cetera, to the backend systems. We will take care of that for you. But when you do configure your ICE, there are some network rules that we've provided in our documentation. Say, hey, make sure you keep these ports open, because we have to do our managerial tasks and operations to keep it alive, and plus we need to get diagnostics so we know when something's wrong that to go fix it, take care of it.
Do you know offhand, is there a service tag for ICE that'll, so I don't have to manage the, you know, individual IPs and individual ports, and I can just throw in the service tag, or do I need to manage those individually?
I wish it was that simple. Remember I said that the ICE is really just a private stamp of what we have in the cloud. And, you know, it's not just some VM that's running your box. It's actually a lot of components to make that work. So, you know, we have the logic apps runtime and caching and the connector runtime and the connector kind of API interfaces that we have. So there are a lot of components back there, and each of them have a set of their own IP requirements that you go, to go reach out to, and most of them have service tags, and we're working with those component teams to make sure we make that configuration as transparent and as simple as possible.
Okay, so be aware. It will get. It sounds like y'all are investing in making this easier over time, but you do have to be cognizant of this and just be aware. Okay, and that's fair, right? As long as we know and it's documented, it's all good.
From a networking perspective now, when you throw this into a VNet, I'm assuming this is the customer brings a VNet that's connected to some sort of express route, and therefore they could, you know, they could connect to some of their backends. What kind of, is there some special configuration or some, like, you know, when you deploy your connectors and whatnot, is there something that has to be done to let them know that, hey, you know, we need, this thing is deployed inside of a VNet? What makes it special when you use ICE versus the standard Logic apps?
Sure. When you create the integration service environment, we ask as part of that create experience for VNet and for subnets. The four subnets are for the components that I mentioned earlier, where you have a Logic apps runtime, a cache for that runtime, the connector interface host and the connector runtime host. So each of those need a subnet. And then we provide guidance as to if you want to communicate with one of your line of business systems that's on-prem, that's reachable from that VNet, then you have to manage your own network and make sure it's, you know, the right ports are open. But now Logic Apps has access, for example, if you're familiar with Logic Apps, there's an HTTP action that you can use that's what we call a core action. And that core action, that runtime, now has access to, you know, anything that's in that VNet or routable from that VNet. So I can do raw HTTP requests or my raw SOAP request to a WCF endpoint that you have as a custom service. You can also have what we call ICE connectors, and those ICE connectors actually run inside of that ICE, and they reach out to things like SQL or MQ server or FTP server. You know, all those things are built in and accessible from that ICE to those entities in the VNet.
But, you know, typically all these services that you mentioned, they all use some specific port or the other.
Yep.
And, customers are, well, you know, when they give you a VNet, it's like, okay, everything's blocked, right? Mm-hmm. This is the VNet. Now, so is it on the customer to make sure that, hey, all these ports are open, or is that something that is managed through ICE automatically? Does DICE do anything with the customer's NSG settings, for example?
Great question. So, if you come up to the ICE, and we have both a premium SKU and a dev SKU, so if you want to play with it, you can create a dev SKU to try it out. But, if you go ahead and create a vanilla VNet and create the kind of raw subnets, you know, that thing installs and just works. But as you get into some enterprise customers where they already have VNets and subnets with NSGs on them, you have to make sure you look at that documentation and ensure that those ports that we've listed there are open so that we can have access to those entities. So it's your responsibility. We won't mess with your NSGs. And that's the customer's responsibility to make sure that they're configured correctly.
Okay. And how about like for the egress to the internet and all, is that just based off the way customer does routing? Is there anything in terms of UDRs? That's just the usual stuff on the VNets that they have to do?
That's right. So if they have constraints about, you know, how they want the public traffic routed, they'll have the appropriate UDRs to make sure it's going through, you know, either their appliances or through their or blocked. You know, they can do that as well. So that's up to them in how they configure that.
So you mentioned something interesting about the dev cluster. So is that something that, like, from a developer that wants to build some Logic App workflow or some sort, should they start with this dev ISE cluster, or should they use just a regular Logic Apps in the, you know, cluster and then move their code over to this? How does that work, like, from a workflow perspective, from dev to production?
Sure. There are two ways to look at that. One is the dev SKU really provides you that ability to say, hey, you know, before I go ahead and create ICE in my production environment, I want to go ahead and play with it in the configurations and make sure everything's working. But yet I want a cheaper version that, while I'm kind of kicking the tires on this, trying to figure out its capabilities to do that. So that's one model. The other way that we've seen people do it is that they'll have a dev SKU as their pre-production or a test environment. So then in their life cycle for deployments, they'll go and deploy it to their dev SKU, make sure everything works okay. They'll do their functional testing. And then after that passes, then they'll do another push to prod. The only difference between, you know, many of our customers actually go to consumption, do their kind of development in the cloud, and then push it to the ICE. The only distinction would be if you're using a particular ICE-based connector, those connectors, you'll have to have a process for switching to say, hey, I'm using the DB2 connector in the cloud versus the DB2 connector in the ICE, right? The DB2 connector will require a gateway, and so you'll have to reconfigure it to say, hey, I'm using the one that's open in the ICE. And so there'll be some configuration things that you'd have to do to make that happen. Other than that, that's the only real distinction there. One of the other things that we can also do with the ICE that you couldn't do with consumption logic apps is to connect to PaaS services that have service endpoints. So, for example, if you have blob storage or service bus or event hubs that have a service endpoint, now you can configure that service endpoint to say, hey, this subnet, which is the subnet for the ICE, has access to my lockdown PaaS service. So that's a great scenario that we have a lot of customers using as well.
It is, you know, talking about that moving that migration, and this just occurred to me, Logic Apps, one of the great benefits to it is that it's really a nice, I don't have to deploy anything even to create these, right? I can, you know, there's a web-based UI to build these things.
Yep.
How do I actually get my Logic App from, say, I developed in the consumption cloud and I want to deploy it onto an ICE? How do I actually get it there? I don't have to recreate it manually, do I? I mean, like, no, I don't have to, like, go through and, compare my two screens and click here and click here. Like,
no,
how can I actually move
it? So the easiest way to move it is because if your Logic App in the cloud will definitely work in an ICE, it's just a matter of what you'll take advantage of once it's running in the ICE. So we only have one additional property that we add to your ICE resource definition that references the ICE that you want it to run it in. So as long as it's in the same sub and region, you can go ahead and in your ARM template, right, for deploying your Logic App, you add that property, which is the integration service environment property, and say, when I now do a put against ARM, ARM will route it to our Logic App's which will then know where the ICE is and then deploy it to the ICE.
Okay, so I don't have to make all these wholesale changes. Once I export my ARM template or create my ARM template, I don't have to make a whole bunch of wholesale changes to get
that's
it over.
Right. There's just one little piece that you have to add, and then it's good to go. And you can parameterize that to say, you know, as part of your deployment processes, you'll have a different parameter file for each environment, and you can have a consumption parameter file versus a dev SKU parameter file versus production parameter file, and that's just going to change, you know, whether the ICE is there and which ICE you're pointing to.
Great. That's super easy.
So Kevin, you know, how is the storage kind of isolated in this, right? I mean, I know customers use ICE because they want to make sure they're not in a multi-tenanted environment. Like, so how do you keep like all the metadata storage, like also, separate from everybody else?
So one of the things I mentioned earlier was, there's a lot of stuff going on in that ICE, right? It's the same as our cloud deployment model. And so the two things that you get with that model, besides, of course, the VNet integration, is dedicated compute and isolated storage. So with dedicated compute, what that means is that nobody else is running on those nodes in that ICE. So you get the compute is all dedicated to your Logic Apps. You know, one of the great things about Logic Apps consumption, it's a multi-tenant service and it's massively scaled, but you know, and it's secure and locked down, but you're running side by side with other guys' workloads. And you know, if some guy comes in with a semi-truck worth of work, you know, you may get throttled or you know, you may have different performance that occurs because of that workload that's happening, you know, next to you. With the ICE, you can only do that to yourself. Nobody else, you know, in the world can share that compute that we've given to you. Also for storage, when we create the ICE, we actually give you your own private storage instance. So all the data that's recorded for your logic app. So one of the nice things about logic apps is we have a monitoring view, which gives you run history. So you can see the inputs and outputs of every step along the way, and you get a nice visual view of that history for that logic app. And so all that inputs and outputs is now stored in your private instance of storage that you only have access to, and they can control how that's accessed.
And is there some sort of limit on that, or what are the best practices and what people should store in that? Does the customer have access to that storage, or just use behind the covers by logic apps?
Storage is the implementation detail. So meaning that there's a we have APIs to go get to the run history, and so you don't explicitly put things in there. It's a side effect of your runs. So, we use that storage to store all the input and output data from your run history. And then we give you the appropriate APIs and, of course, a portal experience to go access that that information.
So you're actually talking, this is, and I think you said it this way, but the runtime storage, not Azure storage, where I would put my, my blobs and my containers and stuff at this point. This is a different concept than that. This is just for the data associated with running your apps and logs.
Exactly. Great. It's not just some open-ended storage where you can stick whatever you want in there. It's the component under the covers that's where we put our history into.
Okay.
And so that history, storage is dedicated just to you. There's nobody else who has it in there. Now, even in the cloud, everything's encrypted, just like in the ICE, and nobody else can get to it. But, we have a lot of, financial companies, and they have compliance that says, anytime I store data, it cannot be next to anybody else's data. And that's just a compliance requirement. And so now you can accomplish that with the ICE.
Great.
How many IP addresses does it take up in the subnet? Is that something that customers need to budget for?
Yes, there's a minimum requirement for the size of the subnet. And it's for each of the four subnets, it's a /27.
Okay. And it uses up all the IPs like in some sort of a DHCP manner there.
Well, it's what we've done is when you create the ICE, we don't use all those IP addresses at once. It allows for the scalability that's in that ICE. So, as we scale up and down, you don't have to go and reconfigure your subnet. We've already pre-allocated all those IP addresses for you so that you don't have to worry about it later.
Excellent. I noticed in some of the documentation I read, it said something that you're limited to one enterprise connector. Is that correct?
No, that used to be true. But now it should be updated in the pricing page. With the ICE, you get to use as many enterprise connectors as you want. So that's all included with the ICE. So with the ICE, not only do you get to use the enterprise connector. So in the cloud, for those who don't know, there's we have, I think, three enterprise class connectors today, which is SAP, MQ, and the IBM 3270. And those have a different metering rate when you use those enterprise connectors in consumption. But if you use an ICE, then those are included just like any other standard connector. They're not metered in the ICE. So you get to go party on that all you want. The other thing that gets included with the ICE is a standard integration account. So, typically in the cloud, you'd have to purchase your own integration account to do XML or B2B workloads for EDIFACT or X12. Or if you want to do XSLT or schema management, that's all in the integration accounts. And one of those gets included in your ICE off the bat. But you can add more if you want.
Okay. That's good to know. Thanks. And are there any caveats to using ICE, like in terms of the connector support or connectivity in some way? Is there something that customers should say, okay, I need to be careful, I'm using ICE, I need to take this sort of care in my solution?
Well, it's
besides the price and all that, I understand that's there. Yeah.
But the challenge is always making sure you have your networking correct. As you get into more complex networks or at least more stringent rules about how networking is set up, sometimes that can get a little hairy as you're trying to figure out, hey, how do I route, from this VNet to that VNet? And you have to make sure most larger companies have network specialists that can go work that out. But some of the extra capabilities that you get in the ICE that you don't get to use in consumption cloud is, you know, besides that direct line of access where you don't need to use an on-premises data gateway anymore to communicate with your on-premises entities, you also get direct line of access to SFTP and FTP, where before it was only accessible through a gateway. Now you can have that natively communicating to your on-prem entity, as well as there's other capabilities kind of out of the box that you don't get in consumption cloud. For example, in the cloud, you're only allowed to configure your Logic app to have anywhere between a 7 and 90 day lifetime. So that means when I start my Logic app, it can run for a maximum of 90 days. A lot of people don't need that, but it's still there's scenarios where responses from asynchronous systems may take some time. And, you know, particularly if you're doing like human involved approval scenarios or they're the ones who will trigger an event that will continue a workflow, that can last up to 90 days. But in the ICE, we extended that to a year, 365 days. So your Logic app can run for that long.
What? I mean, maybe this is a dumb question, but what scenario have you seen with a Logic app where you would want something to run for a year?
You know, we had the same question, and customers said, hey, I need my Logic app to run to a year. So, you know, we responded to the customer asks. The scenarios typically involve humans where somebody may go on vacation and they don't want their Logic app that has state to die because
right.
You know, he was on vacation during that 3 months he was on paternity leave or something end. But there are, you know, it's mostly just about compliance. You know, some guys say I need to have my run history in that Logic app
right.
to run up to
right.
a year because my compliance rules say that it has to have that lifetime. It's like,
okay.
So we can do that for you.
That makes total sense.
Yeah. The other thing is that requests have a time limit, right? Because it's creating a session, we have to keep those sessions open. And up in the cloud, we have, you know, millions of actions happening at any given time. And so in the cloud, you have a 2-minute request timeout for any request that you're making. In the ICE, we've doubled that to 4 minutes. So you can have much longer request timeouts for those HP requests and connector requests. And
great.
The last thing is in the cloud, you get to access up to, if a message comes in, you get to access the content for up to 100 megabytes and do kind of content transfer up to a gigabyte for certain connectors. And in the ICE, we've doubled that for content access to 200 megabytes and up to 5 gigabytes for chunked access.
Wow. You guys have really considered, I think, a lot of the enterprise scenarios. Obviously, worked with customers in a preview format before, I'm sure, and collected a lot of requirements as you went along.
Yeah.
Good. That sounds great. Well, this has really been a great introduction to ICE. I thank you, Kevin, for giving that information to our listeners. Evan, is there anything else that you
can
think
of? I learned a ton. This was great. Thank you very much, Kevin.
Yeah. This was great talking to you guys. Thanks for the opportunity to share you know, our new offering for the integration service environment.
Great. And is there anything like that soon to come that you can share now, or you'd like to keep it under wraps until later?
We're always working on new things, but you know, one of the things that we recently released is you know, we have 2 flavors of our endpoints, internal and external. So now you can expose your access endpoint to the cloud or just have it locked down to your VNet. Mm-hmm. Also, one of the things we will be releasing is the SAP connector and file connector will be coming very, very soon in the ICE. And then we'll create a new connector management experience in that ICE as well.
Excellent. Well, so if there's any links that you want to share, Kevin, as always, just send them over to me and we'll put them along with the show notes when we post this episode.
Certainly.
Okay, great. Thanks again for your time.
Thanks, folks.
Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to the show. If you have any comments or questions, please use our Twitter handle at Azure Podcast. Background music has been taken from ccmixter.org. Under the Creative Commons license. Thank you, and see you next time.